Hello, one and all. My name is Nupur Ray, and I'm speaking from warm and sunny New Delhi. And I'm here with you all to share the podcast number 5 at Collaborative Social Change. And this looks at gender-based violence, different contexts, and contestations. In alignment with what Collaborative Social Change does, which is to engage with numerous forms of direct, structural and cultural violence, to make sense of it in the current context, and also to be able to devise a redressal mechanism to different ways, participatory method, to engagement with the community. And one of the very important ways to address is also through dialogue, through conversation, and through deliberation. So in that direction, we started our podcast series at Collaborative Social Change, where we engage with scholars, with activists, with students, and try to make sense of violence against women, try to make sense of gender-based violence as a concept, as an idea, and also different dimensions, perspectives, and also in the way that we need to engage to be able to kind of challenge it, to be able to address it, and to be able to make sense in a way where we are able to bring about certain kind of change, not just in the locations that we are in, but also in the global context. It is a complete honor that we have with us Professor Krishna Menon. You know, she's one of the most eminent feminist scholars in India. And I would say that if there is something in terms of theorizing feminism and teaching feminism, I think Professor Menon has been a very integral part of it. There are numerous students, generations of scholars, you know, who have been very inspired, not just by her writings, but I think most important through her engagement in the classroom. So, just a brief introduction so we know our resource person today. Professor Menon currently is a professor of gender studies and is also former dean, School of Human Studies, Ambedkar University, Delhi. She has taught political science at Lady Shriram College for over 2 decades and has also was the director of the Center for Peace at Lady Shriram College. She has numerous publications, journals, and she has participated in a number of very prestigious international conferences, workshops. Her recent co-edited book titled Doing Feminisms in the Academy, Identity, Institutional Pedagogy, and Critical Classrooms in India and the UK is a joint research project funded by the UGC with the University of Edinburgh. She was also the co-editor-in-chief of the International Feminist Journal of Politics and has been a prolific writer, having published many papers, books, and book chapters. Her recently co-authored paper, Social Sciences, Teaching and Research, Its Resilience and Relevance in the Time of NEP, which is New Education Policy and the Pandemic. She's also been, has received numerous awards, especially the Teacher of Distinction Award from the University of Delhi in 2009 and Sahas Pragya Award for her contribution to higher education and gender knowledge from Viscom in 2021. It is such an honor, Professor Menon, that you could join us today from your busy schedule. And I'm sure that our conversation, our discussion today is not just going to make our audience from academia reflect, but also the purpose of it is to actually have a wider outreach. And someone who's not from academics, we could actually simplify and kind of connect in terms of trying to make sense, because explicitly or implicitly, I think all of us in a way have a very shared concern around looking at different forms of violence, in India and in the global context. So when we try to understand violence against women, as I said, in India or in the global context, there are multiple perspectives, that emerge. And there's a historical trajectory to even theorize in terms of how we engage with it academically, but also in terms of how we make sense of it in our everyday life. And I think that is where, in recent times, the pandemic, the lockdown, in fact, World Health Organization was forced to actually bring our attention to something called as a shadow pandemic, looking at increasing instances of domestic violence against women in India. So I think our first question would be, let us reflect in terms of how do we make sense of violence against women in India in the current context? Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you. At the outset, thank you, Dr. Nupur Ray, a very dear friend and colleague in the university system of our city, Delhi. And thank you to Collaborative Social Change. I think the three words, collaborative and social change, they really resonate with me and with people like me, with Nupur and scores of other teachers and students in the Global South. Because I think the one thing that we are acutely aware of is the need for democratic, transformative change in our societies. And this can only be done in collaborative ways. And by collaborative, Nupur, I was very happy to hear you say this repeatedly. I think one of the things that we as feminist scholars in the Global South are aware of is that this binary between theory and practice, between the scholar and the practitioner, has to dissolve, because if anything, feminist knowledge is actually, if there is anything distinctive about it, I think that is the fact that feminist knowledge derives from the energies, struggles, aspirations, and joint work of hundreds of men, women, and other genders across the world who believe that a better world is possible. So our duty as teachers and students in the university is to actually take that belief and amplify it in the classrooms. I think it would be very arrogant of us to imagine that we create unique and precious and original knowledge. The knowledge that you and I have is thanks to the hundreds of foremothers, within quotes, that have preceded us. So a deep sense of gratitude to all those who went before us. And it's our turn to hold the baton, and we pass it on to others. So it's in that context that I will begin answering your question, Nupur. So, you know, the pandemic, as you said very rightly, has been described by the WHO as having a parallel kind of a pandemic attached to it that has come to be known as the shadow pandemic. Because of the heightened instances of violence, domestic violence that women have experienced, not only in India, but in many parts of the world, actually. But because we are located here in India and we have greater access to data and information, we know that violence does not only mean physical harm or hurt. It is psychological. It is psychosocial, actually. It is economic and financial. It is denial of health care. So there are many, many aspects of COVID-related violence that women in India have had to face. So if we go back to those weeks and months of the lockdown, when families were forced to shelter in, those who had a roof over their head, of course, were spending time with their family members. The demands on the women, and this is a kind of violence actually, the hours that women were having to spend in catering to the needs of the family members at home, cooking endlessly, cleaning endlessly, making cups of chai or tea, Indian style tea for all the family members. Most women have reported in amongst, a certain section of society, they have reported increased hours of household work, actually, with no rest or respite. And in some cases, also the fear of displeasing the men in the house. So this is a form of violence. for those women, and there were thousands of such women who had no roof over their heads to shelter in during the lockdown. We recall the scenes of men, women, children, and others walking down Indian streets, you know, city streets, going back to the rural areas when the lockdown took away their livelihoods. These women were actually threatened by sexual violence as they were traveling. They, even while they were walking or trekking, they had to continue cooking, caring, cleaning. Some of them were pregnant. Some birthed under street bridges and flyovers and nursed their babies and cared for others in their family and had to cook by the roadside. And some of them, in fact, there are interesting accounts that you might, you know, our listeners might want to look at from this delightful newspaper called Khabar Leheria, run by, you know, indigenous groups of women and village rural women in India, actually. And they have reported that when these women trekked and went back home, sometimes they were not welcomed. So they were turned away. So they weren't even sure of being accepted. Aspersions were cast on their morality or on their, you know, how did they survive this journey? What did they do to keep themselves together? So that's one kind of violence that I think we need to acknowledge. And then our health workers, the bulk of whom, the frontline workers, nurses, and the self-help group workers, the ASHA workers, you know, the paramedical kind of workers in rural India, who continued to work through the pandemic with zero protection to begin with. They did not even, in many cases, have a PPE kit. Few had masks to begin with. Many did not have gloves to begin with. But it is on the back of the work done by these nurses and ASHA workers that India was able to stall the spread of the COVID-19 to the extent that it has been able to do. Their contribution, despite the kind of, you know, many of these women were not even paid, actually. And they were also expected to manufacture gloves and masks by the dozen. So this kind of experience has really, you know, we'll take a long time to understand what women have gone through during the pandemic. And in my opinion, these are all instances of violence that we are only now beginning to understand. As also when classrooms went online, Nupur, if you recall, in many families where there was only one device, it was usually the boy child who would get access to that device. And as a result, and because household work had increased, many a times the girl children were asked to help with the household work. Or, you know, they were not given a space from where they could actually sit and attend classes. So there have been instances of, and not isolated instances, of young women actually dropping out of school, college, and universities. I'm sure you're also aware of a couple of such instances in your own context. All of this, to my mind, constitutes the broad spectrum of violence. But in when we deal with something called violence, it's usually the physical aspect, you know, that is most talked about and discussed, which is, of course, very, very important. And India and its women's movement have a long history, actually, of challenging violence against women. And you know, this discourse that the women's movement in India has or is sort of, and we are proud inheritors of that discourse, that has had some glorious campaigns around the issues of sexual violence, rape, sexual harassment at the workplace, dowry-related killings, and so on and so forth. So there is a broad spectrum. However, it doesn't really help for us to think that all women everywhere in India are subjected to the threat of violence in the same way. just as it doesn't help us to have this generalized discourse of all women across the world are, you know, subjected to violence in one way or the other. I think it's really important for us to be mindful of the specific and gendered ways in which violence plays itself out. And in India, there are a set of, you know, structural, cultural, legal, political, and a whole range of other, you know, the media contributes. All of these create a kind of discourse which makes certain kinds of violence against women, I wouldn't say acceptable, but really common and routinized in the experience of some women, not for all women. So I'll sort of stop here and wait to see what you have to say to me, and then we'll take the conversation further.
Thank you, Professor Menon. I think it was a very rich introduction to begin with. You know, giving us a very layered understanding, because again, it is very important how not to oversimplify, you know, the discourse when we look at violence against women. And therefore, in the same context, when we particularly look at violence against women, I think we have to engage with patriarchy and we need to engage with toxic masculinity. And one of the things that come here is the whole idea that how violence and especially sexual violence against women is largely stigmatized. It is connected to the idea of honor, disconnected to shame, and somehow how wrapped up is the whole understanding around this gross violation is the fact that women end up, you know, being responsible for what has happened and also suffering the consequences, you know, of violence, which was actually kind of happened against them. So therefore, in that light, there's something, some very disturbing instances that has happened recently in India, you know, which led to the killing of, you know, young women, you know, by their own partners. And therefore, when we look at patriarchy, when we look at the way that there is silence, you know, in the sense that a lot of forms kind of, as you said, gets accepted, but normalized too. So some forms of violence are almost as if they are normalized. It's all right. And therefore, you know, it is also interesting when we interrogate the statistics around violence. So when there is actually a reduction, when we see in terms of violence against women, a very easy conclusion becomes that there has been a reduction. Whereas, you know, now there's enough feminist research to support that a lot has to do in terms of the whole idea that women feel encouraged and women feel strong enough and women feel enabled to be able to come out and give a voice, you know, to that violation, you know, that has happened against them. So this is something which has recently, I think, engaged women's movement in India in trying to reflect as to what happened to the idea of, you know, love, what is happening to the idea of heterosexual love, what is happening to the idea of young partnership where women are trying to, you know, make a choice for themselves, you know, and so therefore, please, you know, kind of give us some insights on this.
Yeah, Nupur, you know, this is a very complex entry point that you have offered to me. And the focus for me today is on women, really. So I'm not really addressing other genders and the queer experience in India. But our conversations on women will give us a sense of what it might be like for queer people in India. And so that's for another conversation, actually, but not here today. See, first and foremost, we need to remember that violence does not exist as this dramatic series of events in a vacuum. Violence gets sanctioned, reinforced, and acted out especially so if we look at our location, which is India, what we notice is that there is a whole set of social, economic, political, legal, cultural, religious structures, practices, discourse that in a way sanctions certain kinds of violence. You know, the acceptance of violence in one sphere of life is ominous for it sort of indicates the acceptability of violence in other aspects of life. So that's really something that we need to take into account. Now, in our context for women, when we speak about violence against women, although women by law have property rights, but by cultural and social practices, most communities in India still do not feel comfortable with women asserting their property rights. Or there are laws which are very progressive, but the interpretation of the laws in the courts, we have heard very, very misogynistic comments from some of our justices and lawyers and advocates. The discourse, the legal discourse really is not very women friendly, and it sort of condones and accepts certain assumptions of hierarchy between men and women, husbands and wives, etc., etc. Some sections of the media, I mean, I don't want to paint everything with the same brush, but there is an overall context in which this violence becomes possible. And as you said, there is the feeling that for many parts of South Asia, actually, women are not seen as individuals in their own right, but really as property of the family or of the husband or of the community. And we saw in the case of the partition of India and Pakistan, or later in Bangladesh, a property of the country. So the most effective way of teaching the other a lesson is by violating the body of the woman. So rape or sexual violence in our part of the world is never only about individual woman's bodily autonomy as much as it is about, caste and class and religious identity, ethnic identity, national identity, and so on and so forth. So in a society where, women are considered, in many parts of India, women continue to be considered a burden, at a time when women are contributing so much by way of their unpaid labor, that's the irony, really. So their dependence on their families is really high because they're not really. So what we see from the work participation rates data that we have now, we see that only about 28% of our women are actually employed. That means they are working for wages. That does not mean that 72% of our women are enjoying life and leading a life of leisure. What it means is they are working, but they're not paid for that work that they do. And even if we decide to account for that as work, the problem still remains, Nupur. The problem is that if they're not paid wages and they're not salaried, they have no income, they can't, for instance, go to a bank and get a loan. They can't, buy things for themselves. So the fact that women in India are really squeezed out of the world of work and the world of employment and the world of livelihoods, that makes their position really vulnerable and dependent upon the men and others in their family, which makes it very difficult, Nupur, for resistance and, challenging the system within which they are located. But despite that, it's not as though women are not challenging. And that is where, collaborative social change becomes important. That is where coming together, solidarities, and all of these things become really important. Now, if you look at the recent data in India, so India has something called the National Crime Records Bureau, the NCRB, which collects the data on behalf of the Ministry of Home Affairs of the Government of India. So these are government statistics. So if you look at the 2021 data, you would find that the highest number of crimes against women recorded and reported were crimes committed by under the category of cruelty by husbands and other relatives. That's the number one crime. Yeah. And that's not surprising given what we just found about their dependence on their families due to them being squeezed out of the world of work. So in a way, the question of violence against women in India is very deeply connected with the question of their livelihoods also. So these are the fact that they are squeezed out of employment is violence. That is violence. And that violence in a manner of speaking, it is violence in a manner of speaking. That is what renders them so dependent. So you spoke about, the first category of crimes, the highest is of course cruelty by husband. Then in Delhi, for instance, the highest number of crimes against women that was recorded was under the category of kidnapping and abduction. Now, I want to link this with the instances of, really horrific incidents of violence that you just mentioned. In many of these cases, Nupur, the women are actually in what the families and communities think of as transgressive love. You know, in South Asia, love too is determined by, like in many other parts of the world, is determined by what group you belong to. So if you are violating the norms of caste, religion, who you can love, who you can be in a relationship with is also determined by your social location. So when men and women challenge this, they are committing an act of social transgression. That shakes the very edifice of social structures, that shakes the very foundations of the family structure in India. And therefore, for many women and men, the only way of pursuing this kind of love, unfortunately, is on the sly. Is surreptitiously, so they have to move away from their family, friends, sometimes even their cities. And thus, these women become totally dependent on the boyfriend or partner, they are cut off from their familial and social networks. In a way, I'm not saying that's the only reason, in a way, this social isolation that follows transgressive love in many, many instances becomes a trigger or a facilitator for the kind of violence that we have seen these young women being subjected to. I hesitate to make neat causal connections because it is never like that. And then, of course, the challenges to masculinity that, a neoliberal, fast globalizing economy has brought many opportunities for men and women in certain sectors of the economy. This has made certain kind of life and lifestyle and mobility and aspirations possible. However, these young men and women are at the same time inhabiting two very different worlds, the world of their families, communities, religious context, and the world of the big city with its new opportunities and new aspirations. The inability to sort of come to terms with this change, I think, is also a trigger, is also a reason perhaps for the kind of violence that we are seeing. And in many instances, families actually do not approve of these transgressive loves, transgressive within quotes. And they're the ones who register police complaints against the man and sort of say that, he's kidnapped our daughter. Actually, that's not the case. Or for instance, rape. What we find again from data is that there are many more instances of the rapist or the perpetrator being a known person rather than this unknown strange person, So this is what is sort of the data is showing us. There is a steady increase in the reporting of cases of violence, crimes against women, violence against women. But we need to study and engage with each of these categories very specifically, or else we run the risk of generalizing everything and losing out on the nuances. And when we lose out on the nuance, Nupur, it's not just an academic exercise. Our responses will also be unnuanced. Therefore, very often when conversations about violence against women come up, the first response is have more police on the streets, have more CCTV cameras on the streets, have greater lighting. All of these are very important. But the greatest threat for many women in India is actually coming from within the families. So perhaps we should be thinking about responses to violence against women at multiple levels. So I'll stop here and wait for you to take this further.
I think your insights are very important because, yes, I mean, there has to be a balance in the way we nuance it, but also, kind of keep it simple and accessible, you know, for women to be able to understand, comprehend it, you know, for themselves. And that is why, we assume, and hopefully there is a global audience, whom we are speaking to. It is also important because, and I think we had a discussion before about it, that how Indian feminist scholars make a difference in terms of trying to categorize, violence against women. So maybe we do not use the word intimate partner violence, and we kind of like to put it in a different category of, say, domestic violence or other forms. But there are two things which came out very clearly. One, looking at the data around violence against women, and the other is reduction in the workforce participation. And both trends are a matter of concern, even when we look at global perspectives. So therefore, it would be very interesting, Professor Menon, if you could draw that connection as to how these insights from the Indian context can actually speak to the global, context of violence and, of course, connecting violence, forms of violence to other forms, of violence or perhaps of, lack of freedom, lack of opportunities. So that would be interesting because as much as we like to expand our horizons of understanding, it is also important to be able to draw some kind of connection so that, we are able to theoretically as well as, as feminists, are able to make sense of it. Yeah.
Thank you. So, I would be very cautious about drawing parallels. And the easiest for me to say would be just like race is in the US, caste is in India. I think that's a lazy way of putting it. So I would hesitate to do that. So I would say that in all contexts, for want of a better term, intersectionality and an intersectional approach. And I'm aware of the debates within Indian feminist scholarship around the use of intersectionality. So that notwithstanding, I would say that it's really important for us to remember that we need to move away from the assumption that all women everywhere experience violence the same way. I think that is not really helpful for us because if you look at the global political economy, the international political economy, Nupur, we would see that women's labor, cheap labor in our part of the world actually forms the backbone of, textiles, apparel, electronic goods that are being sold by big corporations the world over. So whether it is, in the 90s, Bangladeshi women's labor in the garment factories that, flooded the markets in Europe and America, or in India, if you look at the labor of women in Tamil Nadu, again in the hosiery and textile sector, or women engaged in packaged food and other products, we would find that there is a kind of connection between, and they are paid a pittance in most cases because of outsourcing and subcontracting of the work that they do. And in most instances, they don't even consider themselves as earning because they do part of the work within the household, you know. So they're not even going to a factory and working. So they don't see their life being transformed in that sense due to economic empowerment. And this labor, this cheap labor actually feeds the global markets, you know, their labor is what in a way helps the big corporations flood the European and other global North markets. So that is a form of violence. So that's precisely what I said in the beginning, that violence is not only when somebody beats somebody else, but it is also denial of these basic rights and freedoms that they, that men, women, and other genders must have. Denial of wages, not having rights as workers. This has been a great concern in our part of the world, where unionization of workers is being discouraged. And one of the ways of discouraging unionization is by hiring more and more women workers. You know, the assumption is that first you need to pay them less, and then they're more docile, and you know, they're not going to, they are family oriented. In some other contexts, the work I did with the psychologist colleague, we found that many of the glamorous stores in the malls in Delhi, you know, that sell international cosmetics and branded garments and bags and accessories, they prefer women employees. And these women employees, so in a way, they are being empowered in the sense that they are earning. But their lives, we found upon conversations with them, are full of violent experiences. So they have to come to work and then completely transform their embodiment by going into the dressing room and wearing Western clothes and Western style makeup to look different and speak differently. And then when it's time to go home, they have to go and then get changed and go back looking the way they were, because otherwise their families and communities may not accept them. So this fragmented subjectivity that many of these young women are battling with, you know, the one is the subjectivity of the lower class, really underprivileged neighborhoods of Delhi where they live, and then the subjectivity that they have to embody when they come to the malls. This clash is actually a psychological violence that is being perpetrated on them. And we need to actually broaden our understanding. And why is all of this being done? In the interest of global capital, because these women are selling global products. You know, they are selling perfumes and handbags that they will never be able to buy in their lives, but they have to stand there and sell it. We found that, you know, the work practices and work culture in these retail stores, big retail stores, was so harsh and so violent. They weren't allowed to sit. There was no seating for the women who were behind the desk, you know, who were at the retail counter, for fear that seating would make them very comfortable and they would talk and not pay enough attention. Washroom breaks are regulated, so you can't spend more than so many minutes on a washroom break. Lunch cannot be eaten together. There's no common room where, you know, they can put their feet up. So these are all instances of violence for the sake of global capitalism to flourish. So the next time we go shopping to these malls and these leading brands that come to us from Western capitals, we need to remember the women and the, you know, the everyday experience of violence. Now, the thing is, as you said very rightly, for many, many women, violence becomes normalized. it is part of their lives, you know, to get beaten up and to be harassed and these kind of experiences at their workplace. So we seem to not notice it. But when it is violence against women who are usually not subjected to this kind of violence, then it becomes a very big issue and, you know, it does get noticed. This kind of, that is also a violence. It is epistemic violence, you know, our inability to acknowledge what is violence and what is not. So these are some thoughts. I mean, we can carry on this conversation.
Yes, I think actually it came out from your response, because now, you know, we are also engaging with students and, you know, all the time. And one of the impacts of this shifting, constantly shifting and demanding global political economy is also the contrast that is developing between the, you know, the rural experiences of violence and the urban experiences of violence. And within the urban context, one of the things that has, again, I'm not sure how, you know, how you would address this or approach it, but again, this whole understanding around the perfect body, you know, and the way, you know, young students, you know, the anxiety, you know, that I that kind of see in them in terms of trying to fit in and trying to kind of look cool and look appealing, you know, and give so many filters, you know, on their social media, and how their sense of self-esteem is, you know, actually depends on the number of likes, you know, that they may get. Now, again, you know, I had this discussion in the classroom and they were like, you know, that men also, young boys also kind of, you know, they, but I still feel that there is something more specific in the way young girls are feeling and young girls feel, because they internalize it. They, you know, long sense they internalize, which of course body shaming, but also, as you said, psychological. It affects their self-esteem. It impacts the way they think of themselves. Do you think that that is a concern, or do you think it, you know, it's a phase and, you know, it kind of may change?
No, it is a concern, Nupur. And, you know, much of history is divided into phases, and each of these phases is really important, and it does have an impact on how we think of ourselves and our past and how we imagine our futures. I'm glad that you sort of took note of my repeated invocation of psychological violence, you know, because often we don't pay much attention to that aspect of violence, and that's really important. See, men, women, other genders, everybody would like to, or most people would like to, they have a sense of aesthetics and style, which is a good thing. Human society has always enjoyed, you know, beautification, and cultures are built on ideas of beauty. But I think when these ideas of beauty are, they don't again exist on their own. They exist within a overall structure of power and hierarchy. And for young women in our society, most certainly, appearance becomes very important, because there are actual material consequences to, you know, how you look or you do not look. I'm not saying that for young men that's not the case. I'm sure it is, and for other genders. But for young women, because of the reasons I stated about the fragile nature of livelihood and employment options, marriage becomes one of the most important livelihood options for many, many women. And in order to get married, it's important to look a certain way and, you know, be sexually attractive. And so I think the consequences of not looking a certain way perhaps are sharper and more violent for women than they are for men. But even while I'm saying this, I'm hesitating to say this because I really haven't done any research or, you know, thought too much about it. But this is really an off the cuff kind of response to what you're saying. But certainly, Nupur, when you spoke about, you know, social media and its use and all of that, we see increasingly that from time use studies that various Indian scholars have been conducting, women are able to access less and less leisure time across classes, actually. And while India can boast about the digital revolution and all of that, but it's a very gendered scene here, you know, and bulk of the smartphones are owned by men and very few women. I don't have data on my hand right now, but I know I'm aware of the data that shows that very few women actually own a smartphone. And the smartphone has become the conduit for, you know, accessing entertainment, leisure, knowledge, news, keeping in touch with family. That automatically then has an impact on women and their ability to do all of these things. And if you go with the way in which I would like to think of violence, then this too, being excluded from the so-called digital revolution in India, this too is an experience or context of violence as far as women are concerned, you know. And what we see, so for instance, just in the city of Delhi, a study was done, and it was, of course, a controlled sample. And they found that that close to about, you know, 90, say, in the study, the majority of the women who are not employed in that study did not step out of their homes for days together. I don't have the exact data. Whereas men, obviously most men are employed, so they are stepping out of the home. Now, you remember the work participation rate data that I gave you already. So because of that, as a deduction, we know that most women are not going out of the homes to work, nor do they step out for leisure or for meeting friends or just hanging out because of the unequal nature of division of work within the household. Many of the women reported doing more than 5 hours of domestic work in the house. That leaves them with very little energy actually to step outside the house. Now, not being able to step outside the house means being unable to forge friendships and solidarities and, you know, the scope for collaborative social change that we are talking about. All of this, to my mind, are the everyday sites of violence that actually build the bigger, you know, so it's like this mosaic that we are actually talking about, where the killings of these girlfriends by their partners is one horrific kind of incident. But all of this is the discourse that makes such violence possible. But it's certain kinds of cases that are amplified because of the caste of the people involved or the religion of the people involved. It's far too complex for us to talk about all of that right now, but I am sure you get a sense of what I'm trying to hint at.
Okay, thank you, Professor Menon, for those very important comments and insights, you know, to be able to have a more nuanced understanding of violence against women in India, especially in the current context, and also for those very important connections that we were able to make in a global context as well. Now, coming to what we do at Collaborative Social Change, which is actually trying to bring about a social change in a collaborative way, to be able to devise redressal mechanisms by engagement with the community through participatory method and, you know, as we mentioned, through dialogues and deliberations. So again, we have a very rich history, as you mentioned, of women's movement in India at different points of time, trying to engage and, you know, be able to bring about a multidimensional approach, you know, from activism to theoretical writing to engagement with legal discourse and so on. But I'm sure that there is something new that is also happening. And also we need to also understand and reflect upon in newer ways, you know, responding to the changing time. So could you please share some insights in terms of how we can understand it better? And of course, how we can address it and perhaps also challenge it, you know, in our everyday lives. Thank you.
Yes, Nupur, that's a complex set of questions that you have asked me, and I'll try to respond to the issues that you are raising. So there has been no dearth of response to the issue of violence against women in India. And in fact, you know, even in the pre-independence period, so even under the colonial rule, actually, a lot of initiatives taken by what is broadly known as social reformers in India were actually in a way addressing the question of violence against women. So whether it was, the self-immolation by the widow on her husband's funeral pyre, Sati, or if it was the question of age of consent for sexual relations, because there were many instances of child brides actually dying since they were so small, they couldn't actually engage in sex. And there was a horrific incident of a 12-year-old child, girl child, who dies because her husband forces himself, 32-year-old husband forces himself upon her. And that becomes the trigger for a huge debate on when is it okay for a man to have sex with a woman. And I'm talking about pre-independence India. So this has always been a matter of violence against women. It's not a new concern in India. You know, it goes back to the 19th century, at least, in the way in which we understand. I'm not a historian, so I can't say about the period before that, but I know of this for sure. Now, post-independence, violence against women has been one of the most crucial entry points for the women's movement. You know, the women's movement from the 1970s has looked at violence as a specific issue, but progressive and democratic women's movement, even prior to 1970s, has looked at questions of women's employment, livelihood, wages, all of these issues. And they have been able to make a connection with violence, but in a systematic way, I would say that it is from the 1970s that we have a lot of political initiatives, campaigns, legal campaigns that have addressed the question of violence. Now, oftentimes what happens in, especially in the, you know, in the government sphere, is that the response is, response to violence against women is to introduce safety measures. And these safety measures often suggest the use of technology, and now digital technology. So, CCTV cameras, street view cameras, lighting, biometric system to monitor who's getting in and who's going out, police patrolling, all these kind of, and many, many other things. I'm not denying the importance of these measures, but it's the thinking that accompanies these measures which becomes the crucial and critical variable. If we introduce these measures from the vantage point of women being passive, who need to be protected. So if protectionism is the vantage point, then I'm afraid it doesn't lead to social change, because it reinforces the idea of women being helpless and hapless victims. and they need to be, so they don't know what's good for them. They need to be protected for their own good. You know, studies have shown that in many universities and higher education spaces in India, women's residential facilities have far stricter rules and code of conduct than the men's hostels and residence facilities. Women are expected to be inside their hostel buildings by 6:30, 7 in the evening, because it's considered unsafe for them, you know?
Yes.
So this safety becomes the fuel that actually runs this engine. And that's very, very problematic, because protectionism, the counterpart of protectionism is a kind of benevolent paternalism, you know. We are here to look after you and we are responsible for your safety. I know of educational institutions where women students have to deposit their mobile phone after a certain time in the evening so that, you know, they can't have conversations with undesirable people. So this kind of, and it leads to surveillance. It leads to a surveillance of women's movements. Who is going out where, at what time, who are they speaking to? And many parents and families actually feel very reassured that this kind of surveillance is possible. So therefore, I'm very uncomfortable with the safety, discourse that is very common in Indian cities when the question of violence against women is raised. That is not to deny the importance or intervention that these measures can do if it is taken from a different vantage point, the vantage point of feminist transformation, actually, to make living in these spaces a better and livelier and happier experience for everyone concerned, then I think I'm all for it. So that's one approach, which one response, which I'm extremely wary of, and I think we should be cautious about that. There is no denying, Nupur, that the law has a very important role to play. Feminist campaigns, campaigns and the legal system have always had a very difficult and complicated relationship. You know, the perennial question is, can law, which is in itself a product of the, you know, power structure, ever address feminist concerns? I think there are limitations. But yet, the law is a very important signal. And it's kind of, you know, it signals to the society that this is no longer tolerable. Doesn't bring about transformation overnight, but we cannot deny that laws against the dowry or the, you know, the changes in the rape-related laws in India, they have had an impact. It would be churlish of us to not admit to the fact that legal campaigns are important. Once again, who is in the forefront of those campaigns and what is being asked and to what end? That would determine the kind of laws that are framed, you know, because again, I would go back to the earlier point that I made. If protectionism is what fuels our campaigns, legal campaigns, then we'll end up framing laws that are steeped in that discourse. But if it is transformative vision of society or view of society that, you know, a kind of democratic view, egalitarian society, then the kind of laws that we would ask for would also be different. So in India, I would give the example of the Justice Verma Committee report that was set up after the very, very horrific gang rape and murder of a young woman who took a bus ride at night with her friend in Delhi, and there were six men. Everybody sort of knows the story from there on. So I think feminists took a very important role and part in that committee, and therefore many of the recommendations of that committee reflected the presence and energies. Of course, finally, many of the very important feminist concerns that the committee raised did not get translated into the law. For example, the committee suggested that marital rape be acknowledged as rape. The committee suggested that Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which in a way absolves the Indian Armed Forces of certain kinds of sexual crimes, if they were to commit, they are of crimes that they were to commit, they're absolved of those. They have a special dispensation address them. These concerns could not finally be translated into the changes that were brought about, but the committee and its report is here for you and me and future generations of feminists to build upon, you know? So I don't think we can deny the importance of legal campaigns. They are really important, especially on the question of, you know, nationalism and militarization. I think this is the time in South Asia for young feminists to begin to see the connections. South Asia is one of the most militarized regions in the world, actually. And militarization leads to its own brand of violence against women, actually, which I've not talked about today, but I'm sure you are aware of what I'm referring to. And to challenge that as feminists requires a lot of energy and conviction, because challenging the military is often seen as challenging the nation. Therefore, accusations of being anti-national or being traitorous to your own country can very easily be leveled against those who raise these issues. But it is for us to keep talking about these. So the legal campaigns, one cannot deny the importance of the legal campaigns. Education is a sphere where I think, you know, women are making their presence felt, but the pandemic has actually resulted in some kind of a pushback. And it is for you and me and others who are in this field to actually bring our students back, ensure that they remain within the system, and most importantly, adopt pedagogic practices and epistemological approaches that honor the experience and location of the diverse kind of students that come into our classrooms, you know. Not doing that is a very, very brutal form of violence, because it is denying the student their history, their identity, their culture. So I think we have an important role to play there. Healthcare in India is extremely sophisticated on the one hand. We are able to cater to, we have a whole sector of medical tourism, top of the line doctors and doctors' medical facilities, but the bulk of our people are not able to benefit from that. So the inequality that is there in our society, despite, for instance, you know, the government trying to launch a campaign for health insurance for the poor, despite all of that, we know that healthcare is actually quite elusive. And when healthcare is elusive, it's women who suffer the most, because women's health is the last priority, actually, you know, so they go to the hospital last of all. And women's health is often equated with mother and child health, you know, and not really seen as the woman is not seen as a body in itself, but only as a procreative tool. So I think health is one area where there are a whole range of issues that we need to think about when we think about violence. And then media, which has such an important role to play in how we conceptualize relations between the genders, how we understand women and womanhood and violence. I think young people know how to use social media, and I'm sure there are already many campaigns that the young, even in our own country, are leading using the media. Infrastructure in our cities and villages, you know, that's very important. For instance, in Delhi, one of the big challenges is the paucity of public washrooms for women. And this, to my mind, is violence against women, because women hesitate to step out and take long trips because of the anxiety of how will they use a washroom. Or even if there are washrooms, they're so poorly lit, there is no water, they are in remote locations, there is no sense of confidence that women therefore feel. So infrastructure is really important when it comes to the issue of violence. And last but not the least would be the question of livelihoods, employment, wages, and participation in the economy as full citizens, you know, and these are all interconnected. And not being equal partners in these sites and these settings actually has an impact on or, you know, contributes to the violence, the experience of violence that women go through in our country, and not being part of decision-making, Nupur, you know, and not being trained to be decision-makers, whether it's in the family, whether it's in the college, and of course in parliament. So we may have a few women parliamentarians, but we know that the number of women in our parliament is abysmally low. We have a decentralized system of governance where we have village, you know, local bodies, rural bodies, but that benefit somehow is not getting translated as far as the national representative bodies are concerned. Women's property rights are acknowledged in paper, but not in reality. There is such a stigma attached to those women who claim their father's property. So there is social disapproval of such women. So I think these are interconnected, and it doesn't help. See, when you isolate the question of violence and look at it only as physical harm, then it becomes kind of a dramatic event, you know, horrific. Then you use words like that's bestial and that's animal-like, and how do you explain this? It's so inhuman. But when you're able to place it within the context of structures and networks of power, then you begin to look at violence, I think, or at least I hope, slightly differently.
Okay. No, I think thank you so much, you know, Professor Menon. I think those were some very important, you know, insights and the way we analyzed, you know, different ways to even understand and comprehend. And I think, I don't know, but the academic in me is kind of really tempted to say that how you have very articulately in the last part, you know, bring together the whole idea that that violence and the way to approach has to be connected to a very substantive idea of equality and a substantive idea of justice. You know, something which we see with egalitarian liberals, you know, John Rawls and Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, that how we have to stop seeing women as means to certain, you know, things, and, you know, means to labor and means to sexual labor and physical labor and reproductive labor, but, you know, as an end in themselves, as citizens of the state, and therefore entitled to fundamental rights, to some basic rights, you know, right to bodily integrity, right to their bodily autonomy. And only then, you know, as you are rightly saying, that we need to kind of resist ourselves from isolating it and kind of picturing it as one event, but rather bring it and see it as part of the continuum, you know, of various forms of discrimination, marginalization that we want to look at of different communities where, you know, understanding women or looking at women is very, very important. So thank you so much. You know, I hope our audience today, you know, have had a good time in terms of, you know, reflecting. And of course, after once they have you know, listened to the whole podcast, you know, there are certain important points that stay back with them, you know, and they're able to bring it in some way, you know, make it part of their lives, in their day-to-day discourse, you know, conversation, wherever they are. And in some way, you know, again, at the end of it, together, you know, able to bring about a collaborative social change. So on that note, thank you very much, Professor Menon. You know, I'm already so tempted to do another one with you. it turned out to be very well, and I hope that is the case with our audience today. to the members, to all those who are present today, we looked at understanding violence against women in India, certain recent reflections in the context of our contemporary times. So thank you very much, Professor Menon, and thank you again, one and all, for joining us today.